This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Ensuring patient safety has always been an important guiding principle of clinical research and therapeutic product development. Benefit versus harm considerations are at the heart of regulatory approvals and of the life cycle of all medicines, both before they are approved by regulators and after they're launched and used by millions of patients. The continuous monitoring and assessment of safety in healthcare is both an obligation and, frankly, an ever-present challenge. To quote an old saying, safety doesn't happen by accident. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, we are joined by an expert in the safety field, Dr. Stephen Murray, who has dedicated his life's work to assessing potential risk and analyzing failure of products, ranging from underground lateral piping to heart monitors and catheters used in surgery. Dr. Murray serves as Group Vice President and Principal Engineer in the Electrical and Data Sciences Group at Exponent. Best known for analyzing accidents and failures to determine their causes, Exponent is now more active in human health, environmental engineering, and regulatory issues associated with new products or processes to help prevent problems before they happen. In January 2019, Dr. Murray delivered the keynote address at DIA's annual Pharmacovigilance and Risk Management Strategies Conference in Washington, D.C. And he joins us today to continue those discussions, especially on how lessons learned about safety in other industries can help inform safety efforts in healthcare. Steve, thank you very much for joining us today and welcome.
Okay, thanks, Alberto.
First, let me ask you, can you tell us more about the breadth of your experience and focus on product safety and risk management, kind of at the general level?
My background is very diverse in terms of engineering fields, and that's a big help when assessing risk, because risk doesn't tend to be polite enough to stay within one field. So I have bachelor's degrees in both material science and mechanical engineering, and my doctorate is in electronic materials. So that's fairly broad. And then I have a license in electrical and a license in mechanical. So that sounds like a lot of school. It was. And it ends up helping because I can understand risks coming from different things. Coming into my working career as a consultant, the most important thing in understanding risks is my interaction with the regulators as part of cases that put into consideration product recalls or other corrective action by government regulatory bodies. That really sets the standard for society's tolerance of risk. And the other interaction that helps inform society's tolerance of risk is my interaction with the legal community and products liability litigation. This is a little bit of a different feel for what society tolerates as risk. I think the government agencies are really the gold standard, but it also helps inform what we will tolerate as risk from products.
Advances in technology such as artificial intelligence and machine learning have changed data collection, aggregation, and analysis across so many industries. Are there examples you can provide of new types of safety data which we can now collect that we have been unable to capture until now?
There are some examples of these, but I'd like to lead off by saying that safety data is one of the forms of data that has been reasonably readily available in the past. And what I mean by that is that if there is some serious injury or, God forbid, a fatality associated with the product, this is data that usually gets back to the people who need to know it. These things are reported. They're reported to the government. Certainly all fatalities, you know, vehicle fatalities or anything else associated with the product really does get known. So to some sense, the product safety world has been dealing with pretty good data for a while. Now, where does it get better in the age of AI and machine learning? I think we're going to learn a lot more about when products fail and pose some risk, but not enough to elevate to the level of serious injury or fatality. So we're looking now at methods to scrape the internet for mentions of products and product issues to get really advanced warning signal on anything that might be out there. And this is an effective tool. There's also a few products that both before release and after release have enough sensors to start to inform us about some issues. This focuses on motor vehicles, and there may be some other classes of product as well, where we've got accelerometers, we've got braking sensors, and we've got, to some degree, trip loggers available in vehicles pre-release These can be used to understand different safety situations and flag the manufacturer about different situations that are causing a hard braking event or an unexpected steering event to be able to guide the safety design. Of course, there are privacy issues with using data like that after the product is released.
So it sounds from your comments that safety data emerging for use today really are related to preventing safety problems. In other words, is safety-related data in a way. You mentioned automobiles and the technologies that are available to prevent accidents. So before we get to an accident, there are sensors, as you mentioned, that alert us to the possibility of an accident and help us brake the car before we hit another car. So is it risk prevention, safety-related data that we're talking about?
I think that's about right, except it's a little bit different than you posed it. You posed it as the sensor will gather data to prevent risk in the moment, but that sensor data combined for the whole fleet can also be used to address risks that are present in the whole fleet. So if a certain driving style, or if we're talking about an autonomous vehicle or an autopilot on a vehicle, for example, if the whole fleet knows that there are often emergency braking events at one point on a freeway, then we can use AI to extract that learning to inform us that there's some problem with that part of the roadway and be able to mitigate it in the future.
Let's move a little bit closer to healthcare if we could. What aspects of your safety experience with a variety of consumer products and various industry sectors that you've described have you found most applicable to the safety and risk management of medicines, both during their development and after they are launched and are used by millions of patients?
My experience working with consumer products is really the genesis of the framework that I discussed in the DIA talk that I gave at the Pharmacovigilance Conference. This framework talks about different categories of products and different categories of users. And I think this is really quite applicable to medicines, to pharmaceuticals. One of the things that I talk about is the different classes of products. Case of motor vehicles, I would call that a safety critical product, meaning that the risk can only be minimized by the design. And there are also products where there is no inherent risk. And to expound on that a little bit, I call a safety critical product a product where it has a benefit, like transportation, that is inherently risky. In order to perform transportation, one must go fast, right? There is risk built in. You can't get it away. And so the job of the product is to perform the benefit and also insulate the user from the risk that is created. And a lot of medicines function in that way. There are also active and inactive products where they're using some energy, but essentially they have no inherent part of their function that creates risk. And so these products essentially have to be totally safe. In drugs and medical devices, the developers really need to consider where their product lies on the scale of risk. Is this a product where it is impossible to disentangle the benefit from some other risk? Or is this a product that if anything is even a little bit wrong, the benefit doesn't justify it? And I think there's potentially a tendency among medicines to think that all medicines convey this safety benefit to the user, but in fact, many don't. You know, if we're talking about things like probiotics or vitamins, we just have to make sure that they don't harm the user, that are not terribly involved in actively promoting the safety of the user. There are some drugs that truly are medicines that are truly curing a condition. And in that case, our society will take a lot more risk. We're much more accepting to risks in things like cancer drugs or AIDS drugs, where the risk of death is highly present and you're averting it. Did that make sense, Alberto? I don't know if I wandered a bit on that one.
It does indeed. And you stated, I think, correctly that the relationship between benefit and harm when it comes to medicines is a very real consideration. It is for regulators who make that assessment before they make a decision on whether to approve a drug. And it's a consideration for patients and doctors where they weigh the benefit versus the harm that a drug could deliver. Is there any material difference between the way we look at medicines in terms of benefit and harm and the way we look at other products?
The only difference I would say, and this is something that I brought up in my DIA talk, is that for consumer products, there are products that are actively abating some other hazard, which would be analogous to a chemo drug or an AIDS drug, where there is something else that is giving you risk of death. The one thing that's maybe a little bit different in consumer products is we've got a lot more products involved with transportation where they carry an inherent risk due to their function. And that risk is critical. Cars and airplanes, their function is critical to the safety of the user. And drugs are that way, but it's usually in the context of actually abating some other hazard. It's hard to make that transportation analogy. The closest I could get is something like a birth control drug where we have a clear benefit that involves manipulation of hormones. And so in the respect that your hormones are being manipulated, that has to be done safely. But we're not curing any hazard that is coming at the patient from a different direction.
Let's talk about the responsibility of the user of a product. What is society's expectation of how the user should be trained and competent in the use of a product, given that many products have inherent risks? A simple example, a ceramic knife has an extremely sharp edge. So it's my responsibility as a user to make sure that I don't get it anywhere close to my fingers or I'll cut myself. When it comes to medicines, how does the competence and training of the user come into play, if at all, compared to other products that we might use in everyday life?
There's a bunch of questions I think that you asked there, Alberto, so I'll try to answer them in order if I can. First of all, when I look at risk and society's tolerance for risk, it's really fantastic in that society has done a great job, I think, of tailoring the expectations of the user to the risk of a product. So, for example, we have what I call inactive products like pencils or knives, and really all you have to do is make sure not to hurt yourself with them. They're not going to come get you. You have to try to hurt yourself. And the only expectation for these products is that users not be children, right, if there's some risk of harm. Mm-hmm. And any inactive product designed for a child, the child has to have essentially zero ability to hurt themselves. Now, mm-hmm. if you come up a few levels to safety critical products, we see that society does a good job of requiring training for the users of these products. So, for example, as a consumer, if you're going to use an automobile, you need a driver's license. If you're going to use a plane, you need a pilot's license. And those two products have risk for not only the user, but for a small subset of non-users, meaning you could crash your car and hurt someone else. You could crash an airplane and hurt someone else. If you come up still another level to where we're talking about buses or commercial airplanes, where there's a lot of people who aren't the user involved and their safety is in the care of the user of the products, we bump up a level to really trained experts. So airliners are piloted by trained experts who are professionals, as are buses and trains. And the risk of flying in an airliner is much lower than the risk in driving a car. And that's because society really doesn't tolerate a risk that comes upon the passenger of a vehicle, a risk that's out of your control. Society is really quite intolerant of. If you look at the other end of the spectrum where a user is using a product and really has little ability to hurt anyone other than themselves, something like a bicycle or a wingsuit, parachutes, things like that, society is fairly tolerant of the user hurting themselves if it doesn't have to do with a product defect. Taking all that we've talked about there and pulling it into the construct of medicines and pharmaceuticals, we have a few other things which are really interesting, which is that the doctor really is an expert. So the process is different because we have an expert who's the doctor and we have the patient. And the patient sometimes gets training on using a medicine, sometimes just gets a few instructions. For some medicines that are particularly low risk, we don't require the doctor to be involved. Painkillers, over-the-counter medications, as we mentioned, vitamins or probiotics, the patient can make their own decisions because they're relatively inert products. As the medicines jump into the safety critical category or the category where they're abating a hazard, then we need the involvement of a doctor in some degree to train the consumer, sort of like getting a driver's license. And then there are some medicines that are really administered in a hospital setting, or procedures that are only done in a hospital setting where the patient is essentially no longer in control and everything's done by the doctor. This is sort of analogous to that airline pilot example where we've got a much larger risk, so we're requiring a highly trained expert.
There are situations where we are in control, such as if we're driving a car, and there are different situations where we're not in control and we are basically trusting an expert, whether we are on a bus that has a bus driver, an airliner that has a pilot, or a doctor in a hospital that gives us a medicine. Are there different ways to think about risk in those situations?
Yes, absolutely. When we're trusting. We're in these situations of dealing with an expert user, and we as the consumer or the party at risk is under the control of some other user. Essentially, society's tolerance for risk in these situations is close to zero. It's less than one in a million, except in the case, which is actually quite common in medicine, that there is another hazard that's being addressed. So this is really the difference between a commercial airplane and, if you would, a military airplane, where in the case of a military airplane, you accept a lot of risk because someone's trying to shoot you. In the medical field, that would be the risk associated with a cosmetic surgery. There's going to be very little tolerance for a bad outcome or a death associated with cosmetic surgery. There's much, much more risk tolerance associated with an expert user and a hazard that's present. So if we're doing a triple bypass because the patient is potentially in harm's way, then there's a lot of risk tolerance for that. And the risk tolerance in the case where there's a present hazard goes up to, but of course can't exceed, the risk that's already present.
Any surgeon will say to a patient, all surgeries are risky. But you're saying, I think correctly, that somebody subjecting themselves to cosmetic surgery will expect a great outcome and no risk. Is that an unreasonable expectation on the part of a cosmetic surgery patient?
You're correct that all surgery is dangerous, and I'm not that familiar with the numbers of adverse outcomes that are truly threatening to the well-being of the patient coming out of cosmetic surgery. But the information that I have from the world of safety critical operations in other products, consumer products, industrial products, suggest that there is very little tolerance for any risk of harm being created by something like a cosmetic surgery. And I think one easy place to go to understand society's tolerance for that is where we see litigation that follows an adverse outcome from a cosmetic surgery. And my understanding is that it's pretty darn common if there's an adverse outcome.
Our car does not warn us as we get into it that we're about to enter a risky situation when we drive on a busy highway, nor does the pilot of an airline remind us every time that flying is risky. Should they? Should a car speak to us about the risk we're just about to undertake? Should a pilot remind us that flying is risky?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I really have the answer to that, Alberto. What you're talking about, the car that you're the driver of and the airliner that you're on are actually really two very different risk categories. The tolerance of society for risk of fatalities on airliners is effectively zero. And what that means is that if there's a problem that causes a fatality on an airliner, there will be corrective action. And if that problem persists, we will stop using that airliner. In the United States, major air carriers can go many years in a row without a single fatality. And that's the way they like it. So that risk category, that risk is driving to zero. When you're in your own vehicle, it's a much, much higher risk there. And when you first asked the question, the first thing I thought of is that your cars actually do these days often tell you if you're in a risky situation. Because my wife's car, if you're coming too fast toward the car in front of you, it starts beeping at you. Or if you want to make a lane change and someone in your blind spot, it starts letting you know. There are situations where the products are actually getting smart enough to warn you about risky situations.
Moving to another question, how should we think about the difference between the inherent risk of a product and a defect in that same product?
Well, this is something that society really treats very differently. Society is pretty understanding that many products, and especially transportation products, come with risks. If you want to do transportation, you have to go fast, and that carries some risk. But what they're not tolerant of, and our society is not tolerant of, is that some fault of the product creates an additional risk. If you're driving a car at 65 miles an hour, if you swerve into a telephone pole, the outcome's likely to be bad. And that is related to the fundamental risk of going fast. If you're driving a car at 65 miles an hour and the wheel falls off because one of the shafts was underdesigned, that really is a defect. And we see through the history of regulatory action that our society really doesn't tolerate that sort of thing. So if there's a systematic issue with a product that creates an extra risk beyond the inherent risk, it won't be tolerated. An analogy that I used for the DIA was that of a wingsuit. And I don't know if everybody understands a wingsuit. It's a suit that you can wear while parachuting before you pull the main chute. that allows you to fly sort of looks a bit like a flying squirrel. And oftentimes athletes and other people seeking a particular thrill will jump off a big cliff in a wingsuit and fly very close to the ground. They make some tremendous videos and then pull the chute. And as you can imagine, this is just phenomenally risky to fly close to the ground in a wingsuit. There's lots and lots of records of incidents. And because you're only risking your own life, our society is somewhat tolerant of this risk, because you're allowed to hurt yourself as long as you're not hurting anyone else is really where it comes down to on society's tolerance for risk. However, if there was something about that wingsuit that caused it to tear prematurely or one of the sides to fall off that was truly a product defect, that would get addressed very quickly. It really would. Our society's tolerance for taking your own control and for something out of your control happening are just quite different.
Relating this to medicines, you know, chemotherapy is inherently risky. There's a benefit to it, of course, but there's also the risk of hair loss and a lot of vomiting and many other side effects. People accept that, but people, I guess, would not accept that a chemotherapeutic drug contains contaminants that should
Absolutely.
Not be there and may cause additional problems such as toxic shock, for instance, or a stroke or other things that are not expected in that product.
Absolutely. And with regard to medicine, every time I think of this analogy of what does a defect look like, it looks like a contaminant.
Final question, Steve. Let's talk about catastrophic events. Catastrophic events have perhaps somewhat different meanings in an industry like aerospace and another industry like healthcare. But when they involve large numbers of people, whether they be passengers or patients, those meanings, I guess, tend to converge and they do attract global attention. Is there maybe a different way to think about catastrophic events in healthcare? I'm thinking also of the current coronavirus epidemic and the global concerns around that. What are your thoughts about this?
I think some pretty clear distinctions that we can use to help our thinking about risk when we talk about catastrophic events in healthcare and catastrophic events in the product world. First of all, is just the timescale. Catastrophic events in healthcare tend to take at least weeks or months to play out. We've been dealing with the coronavirus for about a month now. A catastrophic event with a product, a train or an airliner, or even a motor vehicle takes seconds or maybe minutes to play out. So there's much less opportunity for interaction. If something goes wrong with an engineering product, usually the problem presents itself very, very quickly, and there's little time to react. Now, the second big distinction is that catastrophic events in healthcare tend to be related to some external cause. Obviously, coronavirus, the virus that came out of central China, no one knew about it, and it's something that we're fundamentally reacting to, which presents the problem that it's unknown, it's very difficult to respond to. Even though we've got some time, it's very difficult to respond to and may take some time and more to develop the right responses. Now, when we're talking about products, all the risks tend to be encapsulated in the products themselves before they're even sold. So we can study those risks, we can understand them ahead of time. We're not in a fundamentally reactive mode. Now, if there's an issue, of course, we've got very little time to react with a product, but the good news is we've been able to study the product for a long time ahead. With catastrophes in healthcare, we've got a longer scale to react, but we've got very little ability to prepare as a society for what the next thing coming is. I know that the people at the Centers for Disease Control would either be happy to hear me acknowledge that or would be offended that they've been preparing for diseases they don't know about. But it's hard to prepare for the risks you don't know about.
In the case of a catastrophic event that develops gradually over time, as you pointed out, does current technology, including social media, help us identify the emergence and evolution of a catastrophic event that in years past might have taken many months to detect, and these days might take days to detect? For example, a contaminated medicine that many people are taking, would the current technology and social media help us identify that there are, you know, several thousand people across the country experiencing the same symptoms in the same week?
The answer to that is probably. I'm not totally sure. And it really relates, Alberto, to one of the very first things we talked about with big data and AI, which is we will definitely get signal faster by the sheer volume of communication that is happening in the world now. There's just much more communication than there used to be. given the internet, given social media, given all the ways that people reach out to each other, it's easier for more people to know about something that they might need to know about. That said, for a long time now, any risk event that's critical enough tends to get attention pretty fast. So if this is an adverse drug event and people are going back to their doctor, I would expect that the doctors would relay that information fairly quickly. They may or may not. You know that field better than I do. But this is something, at least in the products world, where that information would get relayed fairly quickly. In the world of hypercommunication that we live in today, yes, we will know more faster, but it may only be a few days. I don't know how much that will change our ability to react, is maybe the best way to say it.
In the world of our listeners, there is a lot of talk these days about real-world data and real-world evidence. And a lot of real-world data are being collected in all kinds of settings, including hospitals and medical centers, through electronic health records. So there are vast amounts of real-world data being collected every day, every minute.
Yeah.
Whether those data constitute evidence is very much a discussion. And data becomes evidence when it's actionable, when it's solid, when it's sort of proven in some way. Does this resonate with what you know from other products, that one can have a lot of data, but before one has evidence that is actionable, that might take a little while?
I think that's absolutely right, Alberto. We have, especially in the automotive space, you'll get a lot of data. In consumer products, you'll get less data, and it's harder to know what is actionable. But this really relates to my previous answer, which was that we're getting a lot of data in the hospital setting. So to get this additional source from somewhere like social media, frankly, that's much less actionable data that we're getting unless we follow up with a phone call or reach out to the person on social media to turn that data, turn that signal into evidence, like you just said. Actually, a funny example of that is a good friend of mine once posted that his battery charger melted. He posted that up onto Facebook. And I immediately, since I knew him and I knew the manufacturer, got the two of them together. So we were able to turn that social media post into real evidence to deal with the problem quite quickly. If that were able to happen, if we had a system to make that happen, that would be interesting. Hospital data is much closer to real evidence if we've got a doctor that's evaluating what the signal is, and then that can be used to make decisions going forward.
Well, on that note, Steve, I want to thank you. This is the end of our conversation. Thank you for your insights from other industries. Very important discussion around safety of products and safety of medicines in particular. Much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Alberto, and have a wonderful day.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.